Our reading this morning is from St. Mark's Gospel, chapter 15, verses 1 to 20. Very early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders, the teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin reached a decision. They bound Jesus, led him away, and turned him over to Pilate. "Are you king of the Jews?" asked Pilate. "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. The chief priests accused him of many things. So again Pilate asked him, "Aren't you going to answer? See how many things they are accusing you of." But Jesus still made no reply, and Pilate was amazed. Now it was a custom at the feast to release a prisoner whom the people requested. A man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the uprising. The crowd came up and asked Pilate to do for them what he usually did. "Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate, knowing that it was out of envy that the chief priest had handed Jesus over to him. But the chief priest stirred up the crowd to have Pilate release Barabbas instead. "What shall I do then with the one you call the king of the Jews?" Pilate asked them. "Crucify him," they shouted. "Why, what crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him!" Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified.
Continuing at verse 16, the soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that is, the praetorium, and called together the whole company of soldiers. They put a purple robe on him, then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on him. And they began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Again and again they struck him on the head with a staff and spat on him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him out to crucify him. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
There's a sense in which we are on holy ground today. So let us pray. Heavenly Father, we bow in your presence. May your word be our rule. May your spirit be our teacher. And may your greater glory be our supreme concern. In Jesus' name, amen. I thought I'd do something a little different today, and I'm going to play you a couple of pieces of music. And both are taken as extracts from larger works, and much as I would love to play you the whole thing, that would probably take up more than the whole service. So what I've done is I've cut these extracts just down to 2 minutes. I wouldn't be surprised if one or both were not your cup of tea. That's fine. You're allowed to have your own opinions on the whole. I want you to listen carefully as I play these two pieces. Now, the first one is hopefully going to be familiar to nearly everybody, either because you heard it at the coronation last year or because you follow the Champions League. Because the end of civilization has come, and this is used for the theme tune for the Champions League. I don't know what they were thinking or how it got passed, but anyway, there's nothing I can do about that. And of course, it is from one of George Frederick Handel's coronation anthems, written for the coronation of George II, all the way back in 1727, but you knew that, and actually you probably know what's coming now. And it's been used in every coronation since, including last year. And I would say, actually, what you have is musical perfection. But sadly, here's just 2 minutes of Zadok the priest. Have to stop somewhere. Now, I particularly chose that recording because I quite enjoy the fact that it's an amateur choir from the United States singing God Save the King, which pleased me. but anyway, I wonder what sort of adjectives you might use to describe that. What's the sort of atmosphere? Well, I jotted down a few. It's sort of dignified. It's majestic. It's respectful, it's triumphal, it's honoring. There's grandeur to it. There's a sense of occasion to it. Basically, Handel manages to achieve sort of alchemy with some very straightforward musical content, ingredients, into something that really is stunning. Here's a second piece. Now, this is written by a Latvian composer called Eriks Eschenvalds. And actually, he's one of my favorite living composers. And he's a believer. And this is from the start of his St. Luke Passion, which was premiered just 10 years ago, less than 10 years ago. And there's no overture, no introduction at all. This is literally how the whole thing begins.
chastise him, and let him go.
How might you describe that one? Violent, discordant, disturbing, visceral, irrational, full of rage, fury. And from Pilate, pleading and incomprehension. Why? Now, imagine if last year at the coronation, Charles and Camilla processed into Westminster Abbey to that. It would be utterly inappropriate, disturbing. It would probably cause a riot. Crucify him! It makes no sense. Well, if you sense that, then you're now beginning to get it. Because what we begin to sense is how utterly monstrous these chapters are. In chapter 14, we saw the scandal of the so-called trial of Jesus. It wasn't a trial. It was a joke. A stitch-up before the Sanhedrin. The definition, if you like, of a kangaroo court. And the goal was clear from the start. Just look back at just over the page, chapter 14, verse 64. They all condemned him as worthy of death. Worthy? Worthy? That word, as I was reading this again, just stop me in my tracks. Haven't they spent any time with Jesus? Don't they know what he's like? Worthy of death? But then I suppose the way Mark tells it, we shouldn't be surprised, because actually all the way back in chapter 3, we find these words, chapter 3, verse 6, the Pharisees began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. It's only two chapters into the book. They're already plotting to do away with him. It's only just beginning. It's incredible. In chapter 3, it was just the Pharisees and the Herodians, if you like. It's the preachers and the politicians. But by the time we get to chapter 15, our chapter, well, we now have a full house. The temple priests have joined in. All were represented in the Sanhedrin, the Jewish court. The three groups despised each other, the preachers, the politicians, and the priests. But they were brought together by the threat of Jesus. And so the story continues with them figuring out, well, how are they going to get their sentence carried out? Because, of course, they don't have ultimate power. They are a subject state to Rome. They'll do whatever they can to get rid of him, because he's worthy of death. It's monstrous, isn't it? What continues in chapter 15 is basically things escalating but getting worse, but the trajectory is the same all the way through. And the first thing we see is, well, what I've called a mockery of justice. I mean, so much of this scene is dodgy. I mean, it's at night still. So it's the same night that he was arrested and he was in quotes, on trial in the Sanhedrin, and they need a Roman rubber stamp. And Mark reinforces the point in verse 1. Yes, there really is agreement between the priests, the elders, and the Pharisees. Who'd have believed it? These guys can't stand each other. Be like the Tories, Labour, the Lib Dems, and the Greens, all agreeing on something. The Sanhedrin might be a hotbed of debate and rivalry, but on this they have consensus. Jesus must die. Now, I can't imagine that Pilate was particularly pleased to be dragged out of bed for this. I mean, I imagine him sort of coming in yawning and bleary-eyed. What now? And so he doesn't waste any time. He wants to get straight to the point and presumably get straight back to bed. Are you the king of the Jews? He says in verse 2. Now, I don't really understand why, but the NIV, the old NIV, which is the one we have, translates it in a weird way. So it translates it, Jesus saying, yes, it is as you say. Now, no other translation puts it like that. Not a single one. And the Greek basically is much more natural to translate actually in the way that the new NIV corrects. The new NIV has Jesus say, you have said so. I would sort of take it, it's much more like, well, if you say so, or so you say. In other words, Jesus is not denying it, but he's not affirming it, but he's basically going along with the words that Pilate uses. But Jesus isn't going to make things easy for his accusers. So if you want to call me a king, okay. Now, of course, he is God's king. We know that. Mark knows that. But that doesn't mean that Jesus is going to be any kind of king that they would recognize. I mean, there's hardly anything up until this point in Mark's gospel. You look at Jesus and say, ah, yes, royalty. He's no emperor in Rome or Herod in his palace. And frankly, there's just no point trying to get that across. The Sanhedrin aren't listening. Pilate won't get it. Now, in trials, you expect a prosecution. Well, we've certainly got that. You also expect a defense, perhaps even a defense team. And the prosecution flings all kinds of mud at Jesus. We see that in verse 3. But Jesus seems indifferent. Pilate can't understand this silence. So we read, Pilate was amazed. Now, it's interesting, that little word, amazed, has been used as a response to Jesus before, only once in Mark's gospel. In chapter 5, we see that Jesus is preaching in those mainly Gentile towns on the east of the River Jordan, the Decapolis. Mark tells us, the people heard Jesus and they were amazed at his teaching. Here, Pilate is amazed at Jesus' silence. He's so unpredictable, isn't he? So unsettling. He doesn't quite do what you might expect him to do. He always leaves people just sort of open-mouthed. I don't get this. Who is this man? He never fits into a box. But still, it is unsettling, isn't it? We read this, come on, Jesus, why didn't you say something? Surely he's got truth, he's got evidence, he's got witnesses. Say something. I wonder if you remember those Old Testament proverbs. In Proverbs 26, do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you yourself will be just like him. The very next verse. Answer a fool according to his folly, or he'll be wise in his own eyes. Now, some people sort of get very sort of excited by the fact they say, well, the Bible's full of contradictions and we're very sort of nervous about this and say, no, of course, it all fits together. Well, here is a contradiction on purpose. Because you see, these are proverbs, not laws. It's not like, basically, okay, this is the rule for dealing with a fool. No, you need wisdom. There is a moment for speaking, and there's a moment for silence. And you've got to weigh it up. You need to decide. Is this the kind of fool who will turn me into one of them? Or is this the kind of fool that I can pull out of his folly? There's no rule here. You've just got to figure it out. And Jesus is always wise. And presumably, therefore, the wise thing here is to keep his mouth shut. Why? Well, presumably because there's literally nothing that he can say that would change what's going to happen. There's no point. They've already decided. The Sanhedrin delegation are dead set on his death. And Pilate, well, he's a politician. This isn't justice. It's a stitch-up. A mockery of justice. But secondly, it's a mockery of mercy. I mean, what follows is a very strange and unsettling scene. The practice of releasing prisoners does not seem a particularly common thing in the Roman world. After all, the empire was not exactly renowned for its human rights record and, you know, looking after the oppressed. That's not something it was really into, to be honest. So perhaps this is a kind of special, I don't know, trick to keep Judeans peaceful. Now, at first sight, I think Pilate comes across as quite reasonable, doesn't he? Perhaps he assumed that the crowds, well, they clearly must love their king of the Jews. I mean, he's their king, whatever that means. He's certainly got the Sanhedrin sus, though, doesn't he? See that in verse 10? He can recognize rivalry and envy wherever it comes, presumably because he's a politician. They're motivated by envy at the very least. But interestingly, he doesn't really seem to take Jesus's claim that seriously either. Look in verse 12. What shall I do with the one you call the king of the Jews? Crucify him! The flames have been stoked by these leaders. Crucify him. And, you know, it's almost as if the more that Pilate tries to reason with them, the more enraged they become. He's innocent. As he says, verse 14, why? What crime has he committed? I mean, he might be a bit of a fruit loop. I mean, he thinks he's king of the Jews. That's a bit weird, but he shouldn't be punished for that. But hang on a sec. Just stop for a second and notice the insanity of this situation. You see, basically what's going on is a kind of ballot with two names on it for the crowd to decide who to free. Jesus should not even be on the ballot. He's innocent. If Pilate was doing his duty, doing his job, doing what his conscience was telling him, it shouldn't even be an option. Why are they even voting on Jesus? He's innocent, isn't he? And it certainly shouldn't be up to the crowd, to the mob. But verse 15, we see that Mark telling us Pilate wants to satisfy the crowd. And presumably to keep the Sanhedrin quiet. I can quite imagine that they were a complicated bunch to try and manage. Tricky job that Pilate's got. I don't envy him at all. But you see, what that means is that justice is a complete irrelevance. And in fact, so is mercy. Now let's be clear. To free somebody who is guilty, as Barabbas clearly is, quite guilty of what, we don't know. He was part of the insurrectionists. We don't know what that means. I think it's unlikely that if he was a murderer, that they really would, you know, countenance the possibility of freeing a sort of freedom fighter, murderer, terrorist. But who knows? We don't really know much about him. And you know, the nature of mercy is that it's always a last resort. You don't plead for mercy if you've got other chips to play, if you've got other things to bargain with. You only ask for mercy if you've got nothing left. And Barabbas had nothing left. He was on death row, presumably. Yes, that is mercy, but mercy at the expense of an innocent makes a mockery of the whole thing, doesn't it? It's a travesty. It is appalling. It's despicable. It is utterly unjust. It is terrible. But now we reach the final hours, minutes of Jesus' life. And as was standard, Jesus is flogged and then handed over to his executioners. It's interesting, that word, handed over. Does it ring bells? Jesus, three times in Mark's gospel, in chapter 8, 9, and 10, three times he said, the Son of Man must be handed over. And now it's happening. Handed over to be crucified. Mark is surprisingly reticent when it comes to the details of the execution. He doesn't give us much at all, both here and in the next bit. He just tells us it happened. But what we do find is the executioners have a lot of fun. I mean, it's not every day you get to arrest a king, is it? So what we find finally is a mockery of homage, a devotion to a king. There's a cruel malice, a sort of forethought in this. They've actually thought about it, haven't they? Making sure they got the right accoutrements. They haven't got the crown jewels, but they got various other bits and bobs, haven't they? Oh, so you're a king then, are you? Okay, fine. Yeah, well, all right, let's take that seriously. Yeah, let's give you a purple robe. Now, purple in the ancient world was associated with the emperor, with royalty, because it was incredibly expensive. It was only available in one or two places. I think in Lebanon was one of the main places you could get it. It was very, very rare. And to have a whole cloak in purple, boy. But it's worthy of a king. And ever since, purple is the royal color. So here's yours, King Jesus. And then a wreath. Now, in the Roman world, they didn't have crowns. Kings didn't have crowns. The Jewish kings were anointed with oil. In the Roman world, they were given a wreath, which was sort of descended from the traditions from the old Olympic Games. So if you won your, whatever it was, 100 yards dash or your wrestling match or whatever it was, you weren't given money. You certainly weren't given money. You weren't given medals or anything like that. You were given a wreath and the honor for the rest of your days. And so, you know, this was a sort of symbol of being the victor, the winner, the one who's come out on top. And so it was a very natural symbol to begin to be associated with the Roman emperors. And in fact, you can go to various museums looking at sort of classical or Roman artifacts. And just a few months ago, I was in northern Greece, and in the museum there, they had the most amazing golden wreath. And I was looking at it for ages. It just blew me away with this detail. And it was as sort of intact as if it had been made yesterday. So, King Jesus, let's give you your wreath with a difference. Unfortunately, this one's going to hurt a bit, but we've made it specially for you. And then, of course, well, you've got to acknowledge your king, haven't you? Ave Caesar, hail Caesar. Well, no, it's not Caesar today. It's, well, we've got a king. We better hail him. Hail, King of the Jews. And to show our allegiance, well, we must pay you homage. When an ancient ruler conquered another group, one of the things that always had to happen was the ruler of the conquered people would have to come before the victor on hands and knees, hold up their hands like this, and pay service. You are the master now. And in the British Museum, you can find various artifacts that we've stolen from various places to depict precisely that. You are the master now. So these soldiers, they get on their knees, but accompany them with fists and saliva. And in Mark's classic reticent way, he ends verse 20 simply with, "Then they led him out to crucify him." As if that sort of thing happens every day. And actually in the Roman world, it did happen quite a lot. Now, you might think that all of this whole process sort of undermines his claim to be king. In fact, you could be forgiven for thinking it actually disqualifies him from being king. I mean, this is not the kind of kingly thing, is it? But I don't think that's the ultimate shock. You see, not only is Jesus genuinely God's king, so that's never denied, this whole process was his father's plan for what qualifies him. In the garden, he'd said, "Not my will, but yours, Father." He knew how terrible it was going to be. He was so scared, he sweat blood. The capillaries burst in his anxiety and stress. And there's a sense in which that actually, for all its mockery, this is his coronation. The modern cry, "God save the king." And in fact, people would say something a bit similar to that just a few hours later as he hung on the cross. "Save yourself." But here's the irony. God could not save his king. He would not save his king. Not if he wanted to save his people. And this is the agony of this. He cannot do both. And Jesus knew that. And Jesus willingly went to this. Because if he was to save himself, he could not save his people. No, he says, "I am going to the cross so that I can save people from their sins." That's what his name, Jesus, means. This king must die. So you see, this is actually how God's king behaves. This is how God's king functions as God's king, which means he is unlike any other king or ruler or president or emperor or whatever you like, any other in human history. There's nobody quite like this, not remotely. And that, I think, adds a whole new complexion to his trial, doesn't it? Because, you see, he is silent not simply because there's no point saying anything, although I think that is there. It's because he must go to the cross. He will not save himself. He's not going to. He will be silent. Deliberately. Pilate was amazed. But he probably thought, what a fool. He could have said something. He could have found some kind of argument to get out of this. But Jesus will not. He was silent deliberately. And friends, this is grace. This is mercy. This is the gospel. This is what it's all about. And it's wonderful. And he did it for me. He did it for you. He did it for all. He was silent. Because he could not save himself and save others. Now, if that doesn't amaze you and leave you sort of open-mouthed, speechless, stupefied, then I frankly don't know what will. It's all-encompassing. It's overwhelming. It's just astonishing self-sacrifice. He was silent. We should be speechless. So I'm going to stop talking. And let's just spend a moment in silence, in prayer, in acknowledgement, perhaps even without knowing what words to say because there are none, or with deep, awed gratitude and amazement. Here might I stay and sing no story so divine. Never was love, dear King, never was grief like thine. This is my friend, in whose sweet praise I all my days could gladly spend.